Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Lisa Walters about her study of the thought of the 17th century philosopher and author Margaret Cavendish, entitled Margaret Cavendish, Gender, Science, and Politics. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to join us. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I currently work at Liverpool Hope University in England, although I'm originally from California.
What was it that led you to begin studying Margaret Cavendish?
Well, I was initially reading about Renaissance women and how they're relatively new to the literary canon. Essentially, women writers of this period were lost to obscurity in the 18th century, even though at the time when they were alive, a number of them were actually very, very well-respected and established writers. So this led me to explore and learn a little bit more about Cavendish. And I picked up this fascinating science fiction story that she wrote in 1666. So I can't say that Cavendish was the first person to write science fiction, but she's certainly a pioneer in the genre. And the story is called The Blazing World. And the story completely blew me away. And as I started reading about criticism and what scholars were saying about this story, I just couldn't agree with the way that they were interpreting it. Essentially, scholars have often argued that Cavendish, although she might be the most feminist author of the early modern period, she was seen as an extremely conservative thinker, even authoritarian. It's been argued that she's a promoter of absolute monarchy, that she didn't tolerate any kind of dissent. And I was really astounded because that was not my experience of this story, which was so fascinating, brilliant, and complicated. And that really didn't resonate with me at all. So it sort of this whole project started for me fundamentally disagreeing with everybody and going, no, this is not the book that I'm reading. I just felt there was far more to her than what was being assumed. So although my training is in literature, it really propelled me into history and the history of ideas and science and philosophy of the early modern period, particularly the 17th century. And the more I learned about the time period and I started investigating her philosophy and her science, I could see that she was creating this philosophical system that was actually very radical. And I'd argue if she's not one of the most radical thinkers of her time, she might actually be the most radical. And this is in terms of the way that she views religion, gender, and also politics. So it might seem a bit strange that she had this reputation for being extremely conservative and pro-monarchy and authoritarian. And the more I've really looked at her science and philosophy and applied it to her literature, I see a very different worldview emerging.
Was it her biography that led people to conclude that she was this absolute monarchist, or were they drawing inferences based upon other aspects of her writings? What led people to that conclusion?
That's a good question, and I think there are reasons. As in this science fiction story, The Blazing World, the main character is this empress who is a megalomaniac dictator. And I think people thought that this was some kind of wish fulfillment, like that this was a positive thing. Whereas there's a lot of reasons that maybe I can explain later why this might have actually been very terrifying to an audience. So that's one reason. But another is that she was born into what was known as a royalist family. And royalist meant that those were the people who supported monarchy. So it would be a conservative family. When I use that word conservative, it's very different than the way that term would be understood today. So she was from, that was the world that she grew up in. And when she eventually married, she married a royalist, not just a royalist, but he was also known as a royalist war hero. So that was her culture, that was her world. But it's really important to remember that this was a time when women were expected to share the political and religious beliefs of their families. It's really, for me, it's really important to take note and pay attention to when women seem to differ from their families. And it's not just women as well. This was not a society that had free speech in the way that we would think of those things. All publications had to undergo a certain amount of censorship, or they were looked at. They had to be censored if they were too unorthodox. So people couldn't necessarily speak freely. People who were not wealthy would have patrons. They had them. So I think in general, though my focus is on Cavendish and what that may be the implications for women, it's important to read when reading literature from the past that people may not have always had the freedom to just write out, say what they believe. So it's really interesting to see those moments when there's contradictions or when they don't seem to be towing the line, if that makes sense.
It does. I wonder if you could perhaps then start us off by explaining a bit more about who Margaret Cavendish was and the life that she led, because as you explained at the beginning of the book, her life was a very remarkable one for its times.
Oh, yes. So she was a fascinating intellectual figure, but she also had this remarkable life as well. On just a general level, she received little recognition for being the first person to put forward an original theory of atomism in Britain. This was done in 1653. And this was a time when atomism was associated with atheism and unorthodox ideas. So this was a very bold and very brave, particularly for a woman to do. She's also remarkable for being a woman who published an extensive amount of writings on science. It was called natural philosophy at that time. That would be science that's trying to understand the physical world. So no English woman before Cavendish had published a large treatise on science or natural philosophy. They might have written letters about it. They might have played important roles in intellectual circles in a more informal way, but they did not publish formal philosophical treatises about science. So Cavendish is the first English woman to do that. And it's really important to put this effort into its cultural context. Although during the Civil War in England, which started in the early 1640s, that you did see more women in print. Before then, only half of 1% of all published books in England were by women. Only half of 1%. So this means that when Cavendish was 17 years old, only 42 books had been published by women, but that didn't stop her. She ended up writing over a period of 20 years, she published 23 volumes, writing in almost every available genre of her time. She wrote, as I mentioned, scientific treatises, but also poetry, prose fiction, plays, orations, fictional letters. She was a pioneer with science fiction. So women did right, but they weren't really supposed to publish. It was seen as a bit immodest. So she was certainly a pioneer in that regard. She was also the first woman to attend a meeting of the Royal Society. She was also a political exile in Paris and Antwerp for nearly 17 years. So and she was always a rebel. So not just in her thinking, but even in her life. When she was growing up, she decided that, against family advice, that she would try to be a maid of honor to the queen consort, who was Queen Henrietta Maria. Her family didn't want her to do that, but she basically did anyway. And the queen was she was a fairly powerful and also a military figure in her own right. She led an army of 5,000 infantry against the opposing army during the Civil War. This was done to help her husband. So this queen, Queen Henrietta Maria, might have been an influence upon Cavendish, or might have influenced her views on gender. But she had a fairly close encounter with potential political violence when she was with the queen. Basically, during the Civil War, the tensions got so severe that they decided that the queen needed to leave the country. So she was going to go back to France, her country of origin. And so she brought a few companions with her, including Cavendish. And they were pursued by the opposing army, which was known as the Parliamentarian Army, in 1644. So the queen, Cavendish, a few other people, allegedly they hid in a hut for 2 days without any food, hiding under a heap of garbage while soldiers were marching by them discussing how they wanted to behead the queen. Remarkably, they survived that, and they got on a ship, and it was such a close call that enemy warships were firing at them, damaging the boat's rigging as they were trying to escape and get to France, and luckily they made it there. And Cavendish, she arrived safely in France, in Paris, and she became part of a exiled immigrant culture, English immigrant culture in Paris. And that's where she met William Cavendish, her husband, and they fell in love and married for love, even though Cavendish was probably the most unpopular person in court. She was very shy and awkward. They didn't get permission from the queen. Again, Cavendish is always rebellious. The queen was a bit annoyed, but she eventually got over it. And her marriage was in some ways was one of the best things that could have happened to her intellectually. William Cavendish, he helped educate her. He mentored her. His brother also helped Cavendish, and they really encouraged her passion and interest in philosophy. And even though women were not publishing philosophical treatises, they encouraged her nonetheless. So in Paris, she became a hostess for some of the most famous intellectuals. She would have Descartes, Hobbes, Mersenne over for dinner. So I think this was a really important part in her intellectual development. So she eventually moved to Antwerp, and there's a suggestion that this might have been that it was getting too expensive to host all these dinner parties for intellectuals and the queen, and so they went where they could be far away because they were going completely broke. So both William and Margaret Cavendish, they were living in Antwerp, and they had no money, but they kept pretending they had wealth, even though they didn't have any, by incurring debts. And then they'd get more debts, and it became a perpetual cycle, and Cavendish was terrified that they were going to end up in prison, debtor's prison, or abject poverty. Luckily, that didn't happen to them. So this couple that was in abject fear of poverty, they, after the restoration of monarchy, when the Civil War was over again in 1660, they finally went back to their native country, England. And they got some of their estates, but they never were fully paid back. And I think Cavendish, she sometimes writes about that. She gets a bit annoyed and irritated that they still lost a lot. But in 1664, the king promoted them to the rank of Duke and Duchess, giving this couple, who had for years feared poverty, were exiled, one of the highest aristocratic titles in the kingdom. So, and Cavendish herself was really from lower gentry. So this was an incredible social promotion. So that's the background of her life, where she's coming from. It's quite an unusual history, particularly for a woman during this time.
Actually, I want to take a break here real quickly. I'm thinking you might be just a little too close to the microphone.
Oh, sorry.
Just a little bit further back. I just want to make sure, and I'm making a note. This part will be edited out in post, because I just want to, you know,
is that better?
It's a little bit better. Yeah.
Okay. Is there a way to maybe lower it, or do you want me to redo everything?
No. I think you're fine. I think as long as it's temper thing. One other thing I want to mention is that early, about maybe 7 minutes ago, we had a bit of an issue with the network connection, and I was worried that we'd have to restart the call. But fortunately that cleared up. So so far everything is going great. You are doing a great job.
Okay.
And I now need to, I'm reaching a point now where I'm going to, transition us to the discussion of the chapters in your book, Beyond the Introduction.
Okay.
So, but I think that was a great overview of her life, and now we can delve more into her thoughts. So,
okay. I was babbling too much. Was the problem of the internet connection, was that on my side or your side, or because I didn't notice, but I was babbling. So
I prefer to blame it on Skype.
Sorry, what?
I prefer to blame it on Skype.
Okay.
It's one of those things where, I mean, for all I know, this is going through the stratosphere. It's being bounced on cables. There are little gremlins that are running the signal back and forth between. I've learned long ago not to really delve too deeply into the mysteries of the internet, because ultimately I come up with a lot of smart people who tell me I don't know. So, okay. So far you're doing great. And for the most part, everything seems to be going smoothly. I just wanted to kind of make sure that that we took care of that one issue that I was worried about distortion. So are you ready to go? You want to take a quick sip before we begin?
Is this good, the sound? I'm just trying to get I'm going to have the microphone too close.
I think where you have right now is perfect.
Okay.
So, okay, then let me go ahead and resume us by, as you've already explained, Cavendish had this incredibly rich range of literary endeavors and writings, and you focus on just a few of them, starting with gender. I was wondering if you could perhaps go into a bit more detail about her thoughts on gender and how she expressed them in her writings.
Yes, I pause because she wrote so extensively on not just gender, but on so many different topics. But gender is something that always reemerges. It's something that's very interesting to her. And I think one thing to bear in mind is that women weren't allowed in universities. So when Cavendish is creating a philosophy and there are implications for gender, she's being very bold. She wrote the most feminist ideas of her time, and her husband was always supportive. He would always write front pieces on her books that were flattering. Sometimes he would say things such as, you know, "Gentlemen, don't disparage this work because it's written by a woman." So William was great. he was really supportive. So it's really interesting that he was also supportive of some of her more radical endeavors. For example, she wrote a play published in 1668 called The Convent of Pleasure. And in this play, she portrays what today we might refer to as a lesbian sort of convent, although that term was not really available at that time or used in the way that we would exactly. But in it, there seems to be a lot of same-sex desire, a lot of women together. The women worship nature and pleasure rather than deities, and they powerfully critique marriage. So that's maybe one of the more radical examples. But she also passionately defended the education of women. So again, bear in mind, women weren't allowed to go to universities. Aristocratic women might be learned; they might be taught how to read and write. Some middle class women, but they. So essentially, for most people, it wasn't deemed to be that important. So in that context, Cavendish wrote in one of her scientific treatises and published in 1655, she says that society, thinking it impossible that we should have either learning or understanding, wit or judgment, as if we had not rational souls as well as men. And we, out of a custom of dejectedness, think so too, which makes us quit all industry towards profitable knowledge being employed only in low and petty employments, which takes away not only our abilities towards art, but higher capacities and speculations, so as we are become like worms that only live in the dull earth of ignorance, winding ourselves sometimes out by the help of some refreshing rain of good education, which seldom is given us, for we are kept like birds in cages to hop up and down in our houses. So here Cavendish is arguing that it's a, as she says, a custom of dejectedness, which prevents women from being educated. So this is a real, a passionate call to allow women to learn. So Cavendish not only explicitly questions assumptions that women maybe aren't as rational or intelligent by advocating for their education, but she also rethinks the way that society understood the difference between men and women. It's strange, but the way that gender was understood was completely different than today. Women were seen as much more sexual, much more carnal than men. Men were seen as more intellectual, more spiritual. And so Cavendish, in lots of complicated ways, rethinks these assumptions. And she often does this through the way that she understands science, specifically how she understands matter and the way that matter works. She imagines matter, body, nature as something that's not inferior, that's not corrupt, but is something that is, she sort of redefines it. She thinks of that in fact rationality is something that can be discovered within matter, if that makes sense. I'm sort of, in a nutshell, I'm trying to explain a really complicated philosophy.
Well, that actually gets to something that I thought stood out in your analysis, which was that you in some ways, she's a very advanced thinker for her time. She's addressing a lot of issues that presage some of the ways that we discuss things even today. And yet she's doing so within a 17th century context. I thought it was very interesting when you, in your examination of her discussion of gender and the body, how she does it within the context of the humors. And she's dealing with these issues of hot and cold and perceptions like that, which, you know, now looks so archaic to us, but how she's not inventing new tools. She's working with the tools she has, but she's trying to get readers to think about them in a different way.
That's a really good way of putting it, Mark. I think when we look at some of some of the ways that she can be radical, from today's framework, we may not catch everything. And I think humoral theory is a great example of that. It might sound strange, but one of the ways that sex difference was understood was through temperature and heat, and this related to this idea of humoral theory. The idea that the belief essentially was that all our bodies are composed of four different humors, and these different humors, essentially the way that they were mixed together, created our personalities. And it was assumed that some of these humors had different temperatures, and this affected our personalities. And essentially, what I'm trying to get to is that men were seen as hotter and women were perceived as colder. And this goes back to Aristotle and Galen, ancient physiology. And it was believed for throughout the Renaissance as well. And so Cavendish will often, throughout her literature and science, question these assumptions that men are hotter. And it may not, for us, we may not quite catch the relevance of that, but it was actually, she's really challenging her culture. The idea essentially, and again, this goes back to Aristotle and Galen, this was taught in universities, was that men and women physically weren't that different, but women were sort of imperfect men because they were not able to generate enough amount of heat. So it's, again, it's sort of, it's showing that the way that bodies were understood is very alien. And that really had deep implications for how people understood self. So the idea was that, you know, if you, women were colder, and so that because of that, that meant their humor, the composition of their humors were different. And essentially, that meant that women were less intelligent, less rational, because they couldn't generate the same amount of body heat as men. So it's just hearing that out loud seems very strange even, but that's the world that she's working in. So quite often in her literature, for example, in her science fiction story, she's very rebellious, and it starts out with essentially the story begins with the protagonist has been kidnapped, and she's on a ship of men. They're heading towards the Arctic, and she's the only one that can survive the coldness. Her body is hotter than all the men's. So, you know, that's really her kind of, you know, really being a little bit rebellious there. But it's not just in that story. Throughout, she's always questioning that and rethinking it and thinking, wait a second, this is silly. And you know, we're not determined by temperature. That doesn't affect our personalities. And hot and cold, one doesn't mean that doesn't mean that someone's more intelligent than another. And so, in many ways, she talks about this in a very philosophical way that can be very complicated, but it's often going back to that same idea of questioning not just the gender hierarchies, but just a lot of the social hierarchies and norms that people would have just accepted. Like, I mean, one way to think about this is a lot of the things that we might today think of as being completely normal, 400 years later, people are going to think are bizarre and strange. So, you know, if we were to be, you know, really on a complicated, in-depth way, rethinking things that are considered normal now and challenging them, you know, people 400 years later would maybe find that quite interesting, but you could see how we're basically dealing with a different culture.
I think that comes across as well when you're discussing in your later on in the book the how she's addressing theories of gender in terms of nature, and how she is pushing back against some of the assumptions there, and not necessarily offering a wholesale paradigm shift, but basically saying that, you know, this has been applied to gender, or as gender has been incorporated into this, it's being done in a way that is off or skewed or wrong.
Sort of rethinking cultural metaphors. So women have been associated with nature. So she reimagines nature as something being very powerful, wise, intelligent. And she really flirts with unorthodoxy. She imagines God as having a very distant role. And she imagines God giving sort of much of his power to nature, and he sort of steps back. So for her, nature creates everything. I think even today that would be considered a bit controversial.
You also have an interesting analysis of her engagement with magic. And this is something that, again, to us today might seem to be very off base, but this is time when even people like Isaac Newton were firm believers in alchemy and had an involvement with it. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more upon how Cavendish approached the issue of magic and how she how she addressed it in a way that illuminates her thinking about gender and religion.
I'm glad you asked that, because that was one of the issues I had initially with Cavendish. Is I couldn't understand her interest in magic. She is probably the most secular thinker of her period. She's unusually secular for a woman. God in her world takes a very distant role. She's not particularly, she professed to be an Anglican, but she's not very interested in theology. But often, over and over again, folkloric and alchemical ideas come up in her science and her literature. So it's something she's very interested in. And so that was a bit of a puzzle for me. Like, this seemed like a paradox. Why is this very secular woman writing about alchemy and witchcraft, and what's going on? And I started investigating this, and Cavendish seems to be interested in things that might seem supernatural or spiritual. And for her, she's really an ardent materialist. She believes the entire world is material. And so for her, she's interested in these ideas that are seen as spiritual. And she often is trying to think about how actually there might be some truth to them, but she incorporates her understanding of them into a materialist framework. So she tries to understand spiritual ideas in a material world, if that makes sense. So, for example, she has a short story called The Traveling Spirit, and in it, there's a man who goes to a witch, and he seeks knowledge and wisdom. So during this time, witchcraft was a felony punishable by death. This was being accused of a witch was not something that you'd ever want to have happen to you. So it's interesting to me that not only is the story about a witch, but it's not supernatural at all in the sense that we might think of. So, for example, although on continental Europe there was all kinds of sensational stories about witchcraft, where witches were having orgies and eating babies, and England was a little bit more toned down, but they still would have stories of witches having contracts with the devil. None of that happens in this short story. In fact, we learn that the witch does have a power, but that power seems to be about opium. And she gives the man lots of opium. And then they go to the center of the world and they have this sort of philosophical journey and he learns about knowledge. But it completely counters all the narratives that you have, not just in popular folklore, but most of the publications. There were some people who were skeptical of witchcraft, but this is such a secular narrative or way of thinking about it. And so there's other many examples of this where she really will seriously think about an issue that was supernatural. And you were really right to point out, Mark, that the idea of magic, witchcraft, that was something that was very common in society. Even the Royal Society, which was an eminent scientific society, would argue about not about the existence of witches, but whether that was something that they should be talking about. So it was, and again, it was also you could be killed, you could be punished by death for this. So it was a very real thing, tangible thing for many people in this culture. So Cavendish, that's one example of how she kind of thinks about it and explains it in material ways. And she does this over and over again, whether it's alchemy, she talks a lot about fairies, and she essentially is sort of suggesting that a lot of things that seem supernatural, they're actually natural issues, but because human perception, human knowledge is limited, we can't always completely understand it, so we just assume it's supernatural.
I love that point you make in the book about the witch and the traveling spirit, which is that she's the one who understands nature, not the other characters.
So it is suggesting that there's some idea that the witch has some kind of alternative or different kind of knowledge. She understands nature. She might be thinking in a way that's different from other people, but it's not actually she's not actually having orgies with the devil and eating babies. It's something else.
I thought your examination of her take on fairies was especially interesting too, especially given that, I mean, we have a perception of fairies today that's very much shaped by the Victorian and early 20th century take upon them. As you explain, fairies are something very different to people in the 17th century than how we would perceive them, the imagery of them today.
That's true. Fairies were, we tend to think of them as small. They're stories for children. They're benign. We think of Tinkerbell. But that was not the case in the world that Cavendish was living in. Fairies were, there was a powerful folklore. Meeting a fairy could be very dangerous. It could be risky. They might send you to something like hell. Fairies were often associated with the dead. They could also be very... it could be positive to run into a fairy as well. They might give you gold. It might be good luck. There was also a sense that fairies really questioned the way that society was organized, and it questioned social hierarchies. So even today, to some extent, we have some resonance of this of this part of that folklore, and that often in fairy stories, peasants would receive some kind of advancement by their contact with the fairies. So class was often turned upside down or questioned. Often male fairies performed domestic duties. If you think of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, if you read that, Puck sweeps the Puck the fairy. So basically, fairyland is a place where the world is turned upside down. Anything can happen. So considering Cavendish's rebelliousness, her radical thinking, I could see why she's interested in fairy lore. And it's not just her. It wasn't, you know, fairy lore was a powerful folklore that people believed. But because she's secular, she doesn't, again, quite believe it in a literal sense. And she thinks, for me, it seems that she uses folklore, or fairy lore, I should say, to as sort of a metaphor for the way that she explains her science, I'm trying to think of how to say this in a sort of quick way, but she understood matter as having three types, and this goes in many ways. She's being influenced by ancient views of matter from Aristotle, where there were three kinds or three degrees of matter. So for Cavendish, there's a kind of matter called rational matter, there's sensitive matter, and inanimate matter. And she believes that they're all mixed together, so that every body has some element of this. And I bring this up not to get too densely into her philosophy, but because fairies serve as a really interesting metaphor for how she understands rational matter. When she portrays them in her literature, they're often associated with the mind. And if you think about it, if fairies are sort of morally ambiguous, as I was getting at earlier, in the fact that they can be dangerous, they can be positive, they don't abide by the natural rules of society. They tend to be in fairy stories unowned. They show up in places that are uncharted. They make an interesting metaphor for what she terms rational matter, which she associates with thoughts. So if we think about it, our own thoughts, they're not always regulated. They can be, even if we're good people, we might have thoughts that aren't always great. So thoughts are a little bit morally ambiguous. So she creates this really interesting philosophy and indicates that uses this fairy lore as a way to kind of describe what she's trying to say about how she understands the mind and thoughts and the way that matter functions.
As you've been illustrating, you do a lot to situate Cavendish within the context of 17th century thinking. And I think that really comes across most clearly when you talk about her politics. In particular, you situate her within the context of the most famous contemporary political thinker of her time, which was Thomas Hobbes. I was wondering if you could perhaps unpack a bit her political philosophy, and perhaps also explain why it was that, in particular, that she was assumed to have been this royalist and a believer in royalist politics. When, as you explain, it's a lot more complicated and a lot more nuanced than she's been given credit for.
True, and I think I want to just start with I'm going to just give one little example which shows the way that her politics are not straightforward. There's a story that she wrote called Assaulted and Pursued Chastity. And in this story, there's a woman who is trying to escape a tyrant prince. This prince, we've discovered, he manages a brothel. He traffics and enslaves women. And she, part of the story is really this protagonist trying to escape him. She shoots him at one point and hurts him. He ends up surviving, and she goes on this long journey trying to escape the prince. And first of all, that in itself to me is you know, it seems odd to me that in the midst of a civil war that's entirely based upon the merits of monarchy, you have a prince that's basically a pimp and a slave and trafficker. Already, that's a little bit of a red flag, you know, a red flag about would an ardent conservative royalist write this particularly during this very sensitive political time. But in this, as the story continues, we were introduced to a society where the monarchs and the aristocracy are literally cannibalizing the peasantry. They're eating the people. Sorry if anybody's having their lunch right now. and we also learn that they rape the commoners, they hunt them, they eat them. It's this, and just to sort of to emphasize the politics of this. I mean, on one hand, it's obvious tyranny, but this is not a flattering view of monarchy at all. But these very peasants that are being cannibalized and hunted, it's a fantasy world, and in this world, their skin is purple, and their hair is described as looking like silk. Purple was a color that only the highest royalty would wear. And silk was also a material that only the highest royalty would wear. So it's striking that you have this world where the peasantry is purple with silk hair. So they're being associated with nobility in a way, but they're being, you know, eaten up alive by the aristocracy. So that's maybe one of the more blatant examples where she seems to be criticizing those in power, criticizing monarchy. But kind of going back to the point that you were making, that there's been a lot of perhaps controversy and a lot of differing opinions about what her political beliefs actually are. A lot of people go back to her science fiction story, The Blazing World. And as I mentioned earlier, the protagonist is essentially this megalomaniac. She is absolutely hungry for power. She's always looking for more power. And there has traditionally been a view and criticism that this has been that Cavendish was portraying this as a good thing, that this was a wish fulfillment. She wanted to be this empress. She wanted to have all this power. It can be, and in many respects, this can be seen as this world can be seen as being modeled on the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who was notorious for, who was also friends with the Cavendish family and had many meals at their house. But he had argued that really that a monarch should have absolute power, unless your life is directly in danger. He advocated what would be considered a fairly extreme form of absolutism. And for Cavendish, she does seem to model her world on his principles. But the more I learned and investigated the way that the 17th century understood politics, I realized this is actually a nightmare world because it goes further than Hobbes. Hobbes suggested there should not be debate in society about religion or politics because, you know, that could interfere with the power of the monarch. But for Cavendish, that's exactly the line of thinking that her empress has. But she goes further and says, no, any debate of any kind is going to cause problems. So she essentially this empress destroys all the schools in this world, all the societies of learning, because she sees them as a threat to her power. And she uses the technologies that these schools had come up with for her own imperial ambitions. She goes into other worlds and she enslaves people. And so in many ways, this is quite harrowing. And she changes the religion of the world on a whim. She changes the politics. And although we might have this tendency to think of monarchs and think of, oh, they had all this, they could do what they wanted, that was not the case, particularly in England. Monarchs, in theory, were meant to listen to parliament. They were meant to respect the laws of the country. So you have this woman come in and she changes everything. She changes the religion. She starts wars. She destroys schools. I really struggle to see this as a positive thing, particularly coming from an intellectual who was fascinated with all different types of philosophy and was reading the latest philosophies and trying to and ideas and incorporating them into her works. It seems to be suggesting that actually, the more power you give to one person, the less learning, the less debate. In fact, it's going to destroy culture. It seems to be a warning against what we would today refer to as totalitarianism.
That's one of that brings again to the point I kept returning to as I read your book, which is just how relevant she remains even today. I mean, we definitely return to these thinkers, but she was very relevant in a lot of the engagement with these ideas, how she's addressing these issues of bondage, of rights, of maybe not rights as we'd understand it, but the issue of power in government. And it seems that she is a person who, you know, speaks to us in a way that we need to appreciate more than we have for so long.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, one of the issues is I think whenever we look at someone who's, you know, from the past, from the 17th century, we may not always realize or appreciate the way they might be working with those issues of human rights. It may not, you know, because you're essentially in a different discourse, a different culture. And I think it's a little bit more difficult with an author like Cavendish, where again, her family, her husband, her friends are in this royalist circle. She's meant to be loyal to the monarch. But her writings do something very different. And so you have to be a little bit aware of different layers of complexity and not just Cavendish's work, but people from the past societies who may not have had the same freedom of speech. So again, going back to some of her works, she'll show, for example, in that same story I was talking about earlier, Assaulted and Pursued Chastity, with the tyrant prince who is, you know, who is also a pimp. You have a lot of issues surrounding, well, what rights do people have for self-defense, which was an issue that was really relevant to the Civil War, an issue that was brought up over and over again. And a lot of our own ideas about democracy and human rights have their origins in the English Civil War, and including that issue of self-defense. The people who were against the monarch were arguing, an individual has a right to protect themselves, thus a population has a right to protect themselves from a tyrant ruler. So people like Cavendish may not have understood democracy the way we do today, and I don't mean to suggest that she was a democratic thinker, that just wasn't quite there, but we can see the origins of some of these ideas developing in thinkers like Cavendish.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
A couple projects. One is I've been really intrigued with her atomic theory and the reception of it and the way that not just Cavendish, but the circle that she was involved with, how they helped bring in atomic theory to England, and how pretty after Cavendish published some works about atoms in 1653, not too long after, it became much more acceptable and people became much more interested. And I think she's a central figure in this movement. That's one project. And I'm also looking at the way that the mind was understood in early modernity. I guess this book that I've been talking about has discussed the body and matter, and I think I've kind of gone over to the other side, and I want to think, well, how did science, philosophy, culture, how did that understand the mind, and how did that affect the way that that authors and literature portrayed the imagination and thinking? How did this affect their own sense of self, since, you know, they were working using creative processes? Yeah, how did I'm sort of trying to explain a philosophical. There are many different contradictory philosophies, and so I'm curious to see how did literary authors respond to this, and how did they work with it, and how do these ideas play out in their literature and their plays?
Well, those both sound like fascinating projects, and I for one can definitely say I'm looking forward to seeing them when they're published.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Lisa, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Oh, thanks.